So this evening is already the end of the rainy season retreat. So run out of topics. So I don't know what to talk about. There's always something, some other aspects of Buddhist teachings. But I presume that at least some of you have been to most of the talks, so I've hopefully gained a bit of a clearer perspective on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And of course, this is kind of the foundation of much of the Buddhist teachings. The tradition is that the Buddha, in his first teaching, it was part of his very first teaching he gave 2,600 odd years ago. And then from that, kind of basic, really quite basic teaching, the other aspects of the Buddhism developed, have proliferated from that. So it's helpful very often to go back to the core, the very source of these teachings, because sometimes we hear different aspects of the teachings, and they, many times actually, they're kind of interpretations of interpretations of interpretations way down the line. So to go back to, you know, the core teachings, and at least in our Theravada tradition, we're quite fortunate to have something like this body of scripture, the Pali Canon, even though it is in the Pali language, which of course most of us can't read it, but in a way it's very valuable because it's been preserved. You can say it's been preserved for 2,500 years. You know, for some people say, well, you know, it's be better if it was translated. The trouble is that if it was translated, you know, say it was translated from Pali to Hindi or some other Indian language, and then to the Western languages, we get all these, you know, distortions in a way, because it gets translated in different contexts. And even though, of course, it is now available in English, but we still have the Pali we can go back to check it, to have a reality check of what, you know, what the source was originally. So sometimes using these words, okay, it was a long time ago now, but I gave the first talk, I think, about the first noble truth, the Pali word dukkha. And to be able to have that Pali word dukkha is very useful, because if we just were to translate it, I guess most have been translated as suffering, you know, and I think over the years it's caused a lot of distortion, a lot of confusion. And translators, of course, I can appreciate, they like to have one, you know, simple, one word, one English word for one Pali word, but many times it gets translated out of context. Just the other, I don't know, a week ago or so, I was listening to the news on the radio, the 1 o'clock news, and after 1 o'clock, this what do they call them? Presenter. They used to call them disc jockeys, but they don't have any discs anymore, so I don't know what they. This presenter on the radio comes on to have the afternoon program, see? And frequently he has something. He usually introduces a little bit of something he's read about on the internet, or some kind of interesting bit of information. Okay? And this time it was about, they discovered, some researchers found these certain centers in the brain, they call them pleasure centers. Okay? Certain places in the brain that if they're stimulated, you feel pleasure. Okay? So he was talking about people getting implants. Okay? You can get your brain implanted in this pleasure center and have your own little button, see? Whenever you're feeling a bad mood, you just press a button. Ah, I feel good. Then you see, speculating whether this was the way to go, see? This is what modern technology has finally evolved, you know, the great heights of modern technology. You just go straight to pleasure, see? Forget about all this other stuff, you know, we have to work to buy things to get pleasure. Just go straight to pleasure. So you just push a button, ah. And then he said, well, I'm not sure about this, because, you know, maybe it's a little bit of an indulgence, you know. Like, for example, Buddhists, The Buddhists say that to how do we put it, something like, to live a fulfilled life, you have to suffer. So, boy, that's an interpretation of Buddhism. That's a new one for me. But I could extrapolate that that's probably, you know, he's read something about Buddhism and that's what he's picked up. Suffering, see, dukkha, he's picked that up. He heard the first noble truth and didn't hear the fourth noble truth about getting transcending suffering. See? So we've got to be a little bit careful here how we present it. See? You know, if I wasn't way up in my hut, way up in the forest, and if I had a mobile phone, I would have phoned him up and straightened out his wrong view. But and of course, within this Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, I mean, it wasn't my theme, but the first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. And I think it's, you know, it's important to get a right understanding of this, a right view of right view, because it's very critical to the whole formation of the path of practice. In a way, I was thinking it's a little bit like a rudder of a ship, I guess. I never was a sailor, but I mean, a rudder is very important, I understand. If you don't get the rudder in the right direction, your boat's not going to go in the right way, see? So if we don't have the right view, then I mean, all of our so-called spiritual practice, all of our right energy and right concentration, all this is kind of going in the wrong direction because we haven't got the right view yet, we're not going in the right direction, as it were. And important in this too, I think, is nowadays we hear about so much misunderstandings, as always, especially about religions, because of views. Right view, this is kind of a more literal translation of the Pali, again, samaditi, the right view. But at the same time, Buddha also he qualified it. He was quite critical of not only wrong view, but he's very critical of attachment to view as well. So we can say, well, we're following the Eightfold Path, so we want right view, you know. But the trouble is, the view can become dogma, can't it? If my view gets too ossified, it gets too fixed, it gets too rigid, it becomes a dogma. And I personally don't think that's what the Buddha was talking about. That actually this view is more like, I think, more in the sense of a right outlook. You know, view or viewing. Keep it more dynamic. It's a right perspective, a right outlook. And in effect, what it is right understanding. Because it is the right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, for example. And that, you know, once we're going in the right direction, and then we develop the other factors, hopefully, ideally, they're going to infuse our right view. So this is kind of a feedback loop into it. It's not just having one view and, okay, I'm going to go for it now. But as we practice, you know, ideally we're getting more understanding. Our view is becoming more corrected. It's becoming more right. It's becoming more real, more precise. Becoming more true, if you like. Again, it's just like you know, if we're traveling in our boat with the rudder in the right direction. I mean, as we go along, we begin to see the scenery, and then our view, our direction we're going in gets confirmed. Well, yes, I'm going in the right direction now. And if I just was to hold on to this and just, okay, I think I got right view anyway, and go for it. How do we get it verified? How do we get a reality check on it? How do we get it confirmed? How do we get confidence in it? But it needs to have a feedback into it again. Is this really right view? And if I look back on my own spiritual practice over 30 years, you know, if I look back 30 years, boy, I just had wrong view, actually. Or it was, well, it wasn't completely wrong, obviously, but it was pretty distorted. It wasn't very right, anyway, or just slightly right. You know? more right of left, I guess, than more right of center or something. But especially the emphasis that Ajahn Chah gave us was to put it into practice. Find out for yourself. One of the stories he quoted quite often from the scriptures was about the Buddha's, again, this is not a pun, but the Buddha's right-hand disciple. It was a Sariputta. And he was a disciple who was most renowned for his wisdom. And he was very brilliant, very, very brilliant mind. And one time the Buddha was giving a talk and he gave some teachings, and he turned to Sariputta, his right-hand disciple, who was sitting there listening, and he said, "Sariputta, do you believe me?" And his right-hand disciple said, "No, I don't." Isn't that a bit of an insult to most people? You know, your right-hand disciple doesn't believe you. But the Buddha said, "Wonderful, great, Sariputta. That's really good," he said. "You don't believe me. The point is that you find out for yourself. You listen to it." I mean, again, we need to be a little bit careful here because, you know, it has to be in the right context. Sariputta was obviously listening. He was listening to what the Buddha was saying. He was taking it in, you know, reflecting upon it. And so he heard it, but he didn't just believe it. Just out of faith for the teacher, or out of because it came from the Buddha, or because it sounded great or something. Because he took it in, and then he wanted to verify it. He wanted to put it into practice to find out for himself. And that's what the Buddha was complimenting, was praising. That he heard it, but he just didn't believe it. Just didn't accept it blindly. That he would, now he'll find the occasion to put it into practice and find out for himself, to verify it. Is this really true now, what the Buddha said? For some people, they they're sitting there listening, and they don't really receive it. They aren't really listening. They're sitting there judging, say, "Oh, this is ridiculous. I don't believe it. I don't like that. I don't." So they actually don't even hear what's being said. They don't even hear what the teachings are to be able to put them into practice, because they have their own views and opinions about it. They're just judging it, and so when the Buddha says, "Oh, do you believe me?" "Of course not. It's just stupidity. It's a my view is right. You know, your view is wrong. My view is right." But in this case, Sariputta was listening to the Buddha, receiving it, and he didn't just take it, you know, didn't believe it blindly. He received it, and then he put it into practice to find out for himself. And then he could come back later and say, "Yes, now I not only believe it, but I know it now. I have confirmed it because it works. I've realized it, as it were." So this view is just like having a bit of an outlook, the right outlook on things. To be able to, as it were, practice, put into practice, you can say develop the other factors of the Eightfold Path that can actually be a support and help us to affirm it, you know, right concentration and right mindfulness. And first we hear these things, and you know, maybe it's quite new to us, or maybe we can't really understand it in the deepest sense. But of course it strikes a chord with us, it strikes something, you know, we get some kind of connection with it. But we need to put it into practice and find out for ourselves, does it really work? And sometimes even just, you know, just need to be a little bit careful in this approach, but one approach, meditation, is just not to believe anything. It's to listen. Because in one sense, one way of explaining it, you know, our experience is in constant flow. Yeah, we're changing, we're flowing, we're dynamic beings. So what I know right now changes tomorrow, changes the next second. Yeah. We're in the flow of it now. And the Buddha, he met, of course, in Buddha's time, he met many different teachers. Apparently in India at that time, in 500, 600 BC, there was a time of great kind of spiritual, philosophical, intellectual flowering at that time. There were dozens of different groups around, you know, the Jains and the Ajivikas and the Brahmins and all kinds of different sects and subsects and all kinds of things. And the Buddha was part of that, and he had many encounters with different teachers, different teachings. One of the teachings which he was most critical of was the one we can say, I guess in our modern terminology, is determinism. Determinism or fatalism, you know, that things are fixed, our destiny is fixed. I think he probably in the simplest form, that was one of the teachings which he considered the most insidious, the most dangerous. That we can't do anything, see? We're just the victims of our fate or of our destiny. We can't do anything. He considered this one of the most insidious views, because his teaching was one of action. That you can do something, you can change your destiny, you can change your situation now, see. It's through action, through kamma, through karma, you can change it by doing something. And those who believe in destiny, they, well, just, you know, wait out the time and can't change anything, you know, it's already fixed. And why I think this is important to recognize is because probably, maybe not you, but I think many people are kind of closet determinists. Hope I haven't exposed anybody here. I admit that I'm a closet. Partially speaking, partially. You know, every once in a while I look at my hand, you know. Let's see now, what's the future like? What's But also in the whole teaching of the principle of kamma, there is inherently, you know, if we don't really understand it very clearly, then we can kind of default to a kind of determinism or fatalism. You know, how many times I've heard, not only, you know, many different kinds of Buddhists, even teachers, you know, talk about, oh, it's just my karma, see? Just my karma. That's fatalism, isn't it? How can you know it's your karma? See? Something happens, you know, you get sick or something, oh, just my karma. See? That's fatalism. And then, of course, what happens? You know, just when we hear that, for example, many times it's a bit of a cop out, isn't it? Just my karma. So I mean, I can't do anything about it. See, just my karma. So I gotta just grin and bear it. You know, grit my teeth and ride it out. That's all. So there is that tendency sometimes. So, you know, it's not really understanding. It's not really karma. Actually, literally means action. So you're saying it's your action. And of course, there's many different ways this you know, is in the background. You know, how many of us look in at the horoscopes in the paper? And okay, maybe sometimes, you know, it's quite innocent, you know, looking at the horoscope, because I used to, somebody even, one of the monks even signed me up to an email horoscope, you know. Every week I get it. And I tried reading it, but it was so off, I just gave up. Especially my love life, boy, that never worked. It never worked out. And finances. So it was a waste of time. Or we, you know, looking at the palm of your hand, looking at, you know, And actually, some of the Buddhist monks, not in our tradition, but some of the other monks, they kind of, it's a way of helping people. They read palms and tell fortunes and things, which we're not supposed to do, actually. But if we ask them about it, they say, well, it's a way of teaching people, see. Because you can kind of hold their hand, and then you can flip, then you can kind of tell them about Buddhism, see. The Buddha in the palm of your hand, see? But this kind of background or kind of say closet fatalism, see, that was one of the teachings, one of the views which the Buddha probably was the view the Buddha criticized the most. as it made people kind of, they felt impotent, they felt powerless, they felt disempowered, they couldn't do anything. Where his teaching, somebody, I think the Hindu tradition, they explain the Buddhist teachings as karma yoga. See? It was a yoga, a practice of action. You can do something. You can do something to change your condition. And the Buddha, for the Buddha himself, he changed his condition to be completely enlightened, completely awakened. Going from complete delusion or ignorance of a human being, most human beings, he became enlightened, fully awakened to the truth. In one lifetime. Well, at least in his last lifetime anyway. 6 years. So that was quite a dramatic change, because a lot of the teachings in India at that time were quite fatalistic. Endless, countless aeons of transmigration through samsara. Nothing you can do, just kind of wait and bide your time. And one day you might fall off. If you wait long enough. We get gray enough or something. But the Buddha's teaching was that we do something. And this is what the Eightfold Path is. Here is eight factors which one can actually do. Practical things one can do. And it does have an effect. And most important, of course, is the, you know, it's we understand it. We hear about it, maybe. You know, kind of we learn about it. But putting into practice is the important part of it. Because this is not only got a feedback loop to itself again, right understanding, but with the quality especially of meditation, where we can actually alter our state of consciousness, we get a whole different perspective on things. You know, if we look at our life right now and think, oh my goodness, you know, awakening, that's impossible. You know, look at all the noise in my head here, look at all the attachments I have and things. But that's only looking at it from one level of consciousness. And with the meditation exercises, especially through concentration, you can change our level of consciousness. The consciousness can be expansive, and it can see through a lot of these, you know, kind of delusions, our normal self-centered mind is stuck on a certain level of self-interest and self-delusion. Sometimes we can just step out of it, step outside it, beyond the multidimensional mind. That's not the only way, the only view we have of this is how the mind is this way, ignorant. It's only one view of things, one perspective. And you look somewhere else and get a different perspective. So this aspect of view, you know, we have a different outlook, a different understanding. And you can imagine that this understanding begin to infuse the kind of deeper centers of the mind. Okay, we can have sort of a transcendental, if you like, understanding. Wisdom. Not just if we think about it in a kind of a time bound or spatial bound, oh my good, if I've got to unravel every single, you know, wrong thought I have, well, forget it. Better be a fatalist. But those time bound thoughts, I mean, that's time, it's just a thought too, isn't it? And if we're functioning that level, well, maybe it will take forever, countless aeons. With developing concentration exercises, for example, you step outside of time. Step outside those limited perceptions or perspectives on how the mind is and how my thought is and how the self is. And we begin to contact a different dimension of our being, if you like. Besides the different views the Buddha criticized, especially this view of fatalism, he also was critical of the attachment to views. Even though we have right view, we have so-called right view. I mean, I say so-called right view because if you're attached to right view, it's not right view anymore, see? But we have a good view, say. We think it's right, for example. But by holding on to it, by attaching to it, we kind of corrupt it. And the point of this is because, you know, here we're getting back to, if you like, there's the view is okay, but this holding on to it, this grasping, this attachment, is going back again to the delusion of selfhood, isn't it? I think I talked about it before, about, you know, selfhood, self, you know, has these certain attributes. You know, this is craving and attachment. That's where the self is, sense of self. It has to manifest, it has to express itself, because it's basically an illusion. It needs some dynamic way to keep itself going, to feed itself. It's what the grasping is, the attachment, feeding our sense of self, our selfhood. If you can step outside, when we step outside of attachment, grasping, craving, no more suffering. There's no more selfhood, as it were. There still is maybe a sense of self, but not a selfhood. Selfhood is the holding on to a belief in self. So even if we have right view, even we have, can say, even we have all these, you know, noble qualities, if we're holding on to them and grasping, we're still fundamentally falling into the same trap of selfhood, grasping, attachment, holding on again. So we're kind of, even using good things, it can end up being corrupted by the self, the ego again. There's one category of qualities in the meditation practices, a bit more refined meditation practices, but they call them literally the defilements of insight, vipassana upakilesas. And these are positive things. These are very positive things in meditation, but they can become defilements of insight. The things themselves, but the attachment to them. See? Things like energy. One gets lots of energy out of certain meditation exercises. And if one gets attached to the energy, then it gets corrupted. It gets corrupted into the benefit of the ego again. Look at, I must have some wisdom because I've got some energy. I must have some real attainment because I've got energy now, special energy, super energy. The energy itself is right, but the attachment to it is what corrupts it. And the same with all the factors in the Eightfold Path. I mean, these are qualities, you know, kind of neutral qualities, but it's our relationship to them which is very important. And especially the Buddha was very, you know, quite outspoken about the attachment to views. I mean, I think there's a bit of a historical context, because it seems that as the Buddha, you know, was teaching, more and more people, they were in the very beginning, apparently, you know, the first 60 people, I think it was, the first 60 people who came along to hear the Buddha teach were instantly enlightened. Quality. So they had no more problems with wrong views. But then as the Buddha began to teach more and more people, there were some who didn't quite get it. But they only got part of it, you know. There's one kind of infamous story about one of the monks called Sati. But he wasn't very educated, I guess. He's a fisherman's son. So he heard one of the teachings of Buddha. But he heard this teaching about that it was about consciousness. See? And then he thought, oh, it's consciousness which transmigrates. Consciousness is this quality which is reborn, see? And this was his belief. First of all, the monks talked to him and said, no, that's not the right view, it's not the right view. But he believed it, he really held on to it. Finally, they had to take him to the Buddha to straighten him out. And the Buddha said, haven't I told you, you know, all the five khandhas are always changing. You know, consciousness is changing all the time. So how can consciousness transmigrate? Which consciousness transmigrates? Because it's always changing. And of course, I mean, it's a subtle point, because, you know, first of all, if you're looking for something to transmigrate, to get reborn, or you're looking around for something, and, you know, I mean, it's pretty coarse to think, well, you know, maybe there's a soul, maybe. Maybe it's not so coarse, is it? Better be careful here, it's Sunday, isn't it? I mean, something like... there were stories in the Upanishads of the Hindu yogis, you know, they were experimenting and doing all kinds of investigations, and they had different theories, you know, this kind of source of things which transmigrates was just a little gem behind the heart. And some thought it was something in the very center of your head, of your brain somewhere. And they all had an object, always something. And they tried experiments where they say that when you die, you know, the soul or whatever it is, the Atman, is at the top of your head here, see. So they put some metal thing on somebody's head so they could stop this soul from escaping, you know, so they can capture it. And they weighed somebody, see. And then when he died, or they, I don't know if he died, they killed him or he died, they weighed him again to see how much the soul weighed. And of course, they'll try all kinds of different things, you know. But in Buddhism, we know we're not so materialistic, see, so you can't think about a little gem behind your heart or some little thing in the middle of your brain, see. So consciousness became a good stand-in for it. It's consciousness transmigrating, because who can see consciousness anyway, see? So if you're wrong, who knows? Nobody can see it, but they can check if you've got a little pea in your brain, see? How much it weighs and where it goes and what color it is, but consciousness, nobody knows. But the Buddha's teaching, going back to his basic teaching about the five khandhas, you know, body, feelings, perception, sankharas, and consciousness, these are always changing, in constant flux, changing all the time. So, you know, from that point of view, there's no thing there either, there's no thingness. There's processes, there's dynamic processes, but there's no thing there. So it's more like an energy the Buddha's talking about, rather than a thing which transmigrates. But if you were looking for some element to transmigrate, then you fix it on consciousness. And then consciousness has to become fixed then. So then it's against the Buddha's teachings. So the Buddha refuted this teaching. And it was, you know, he was one of the Buddha's disciples. He was ordained as a monk, and still didn't get the right view yet. So the Buddha was teaching over the years. There are people who heard parts of the teaching, didn't quite get it, and then they began to argue and had different views. And so that's why the Buddha had to probably give more teachings about the dangers of views, holding on to views, fixed views. And at the same time, from the very beginning, he pointed out right view. So it's important to have a right view, or right, maybe it's better to say right viewing, or right outlook, which is not something fixed. You know, if somebody was to ask us now, you know, just come to you and say, okay, what do you believe? What's your view anyway? What would you say? What's your view? I'm still viewing, thanks. I haven't got a view. Well, then you're a waste of time if you've got a view. And if you got a fixed view, well, watch out, because somebody has a counter view to that, see? And a lot of the news these days about the different conflicts in religions, you know, the Catholics and the Muslims, and it goes back to view again. You have a certain view, and most of the time it's just misunderstanding, misappraising, misunderstanding, having a fixed view, and somebody else is talking about something else, and you put your view on top of it. You just aren't talking to each other. You're missing each other. Fortunately, you know, I mean, there are two kind of fundamentalist Buddhists. I guess, I don't know, I haven't met one yet, but I'm sure there are fundamentalist Buddhists who have a fixed view, see. You know, the Buddha taught this and the Buddha taught that. And either, fortunately, Buddhism has no, wars over views, no crusades and things like that. But you can see that, you know, there's a danger in that, holding on to a fixed view. Buddhists believe this. You know, there are, I think the strongest arguments I've heard from Buddhists is about vegetarianism, see. That's a view, too. They have views about that. A vegetarian or not, we should. There are views about whether Buddhists should join the military or not. You know, Buddhists have different ways of expressing their practice, different ways of living their beliefs, living their life. You know, and you know, who are we in a way to judge how they should express their Buddhism, as it were. And we have our own particular views on things is one thing, but it's the holding on to them, and then the arguing with other people and seeing, you know, in the scriptures, the Buddha said it literally. He said something like, holding on to views and then saying my view is right, everybody else is wrong. That creates the problem. Okay, you know, my view is right, but it's not the only right view. It's not the rightest one. And then your view is wrong. So you've got to be able to be flexible, be able to receive other people. At the same time, you know, there is, in the practice of the Eightfold Path, you can say there is a ripening of view. Ripening and ripening. Our view does become more clear, has become more verified, has become more in tune with the truth, with the Dhamma. But we need to test it. We need to try it out. And at this point, if I, you know, I look at my view and say, okay, this is the view. This is the view. But is it perfect yet? You know, am I totally awakened? Am I totally enlightened? Maybe only an enlightened person has really right view. The rest of us got a right view with a small r. So. We're working on it. And of course, when one really is enlightened, then, I mean, the right view isn't important anyway. You know, you've already arrived at the goal, so it doesn't matter what the way to get there is, you know, isn't so important. But holding on to the view, attaching to it, can be a more of a source of ego affirmation. Even if it is a so-called right view, but you know, if we are affirming our view, you know, underneath it, we still are attached to the ego, ourself. So the view is still not right. You know, we're ending up still affirming the sense of ego, selfhood. So the view can't be perfectly right then. It's only partially right. Because we're still basing it upon attachment to the sense of self. This is my view, my view. My view is right. My comes first before the view. See? On one hand, I mean, it's kind of a paradox, because the right view, the Buddha emphasized, is very important. It's the rudder for the spiritual path, spiritual practice. At the same time, it could also, you know, be an obstacle to it, you know, for holding on to it, fixing on it, attaching to it. But if we see it as something which we're using to push us in the right direction, to guide us in the right direction, then the other factors are also important, and they keep feeding back to it. I used to think the Eightfold Path was a bit like a ladder, see. You get your first foot on the understanding, and then the second rung, and the third rung, and you get to samadhi, right concentration, then you're off the ladder, see. Probably by the time you get to the top, you forgot where the first one was. But now I see it more like the eight-factored path, you know. When those eight factors are there, when they all come together, then the path happens. I mean, at a certain level, they talk about path and fruit. You know, and one, in some contexts, they talk about the tenfold path. So I could go on for two more weeks here. The ten-factored path. Right? But there's the eight factors of the path, the eight-factored path. And then there is what they call understanding, right understanding, you know, clear insight, understanding, which comes as a result of the path. Then there is right emancipation, right liberation. You know, once we have practiced the path, then there is the fruit, the path and the fruit. So once the eight factors come together, you know, then there is a result of it. There is deliverance comes out of it. And this makes the path nine or ten factors. The right knowledge and vision. And the knowledge and vision, that means it's not only the knowing, but it's the vision is more like the realization too. And then there is deliverance. That one has the result, the fruit of it. And one feels that there is some shift in our consciousness. There is a shift in our being. We step outside of the limitations of the ego. As before, you know, still, you know, thinking about figuring out the Eightfold Path and this and that, and so working in, as it were, kind of a time-bound and concept-bound existence, which is useful, important, but we also need to be able to step outside it. The liberation, the emancipation part of it. So even though we're working with these Eightfold Path, I mean, sometimes, maybe it's a little bit controversial, but sometimes I think we need to even just forget about it. We take it in, we study it, we understand it. In the one formula they talk about, the study about it, study first, understanding, then there's the practice, then there is the realization. And sometimes if we get too obsessed with the study about it, there's no space for the practicing of it. If you get too caught up with and too kind of impulsive about trying to do the practice, we forget about letting go, stepping outside it. Those are still conventions. You can say the Eightfold Path is still a convention. Still the conditioned realm is still conventions. So having it in terms of, okay, there's the Eightfold Path, but there's also knowledge and vision and emancipation, liberation. Keep that in the perspective too, because sometimes, you know, maybe our liberation can be obstructed by our obsession with, oh yes, I've got to be get the right view, the right thought, the right speech, the right action, the right livelihood. Forget to let them go. Allow the mind to be emancipated or liberated. So in a way, these are, you know, kind of giving us the right foundations. I think in the there's a saying in the Zen tradition, I think it is something like, you climb up the 100-foot pole, but then you have to leap off it, say. You climb up the Eightfold Path ladder, so you don't have to leap off at the end, say. You can give up the Eightfold Path. But make sure you get to the top first before you leap off. Or this is the simile of the raft. You know, the Buddha talked about, you know, when you use the raft to cross the river, see? When you cross the river, you don't carry the raft with you, see? Of course, be careful you get to the other shore before you get rid of the raft, see? Some people, they say, oh, that's great, get rid of the raft. But you're still in midstream, you see? I think when you get to the further shore, it'll happen quite naturally, just like we outgrow our toys, you know. So you don't have to think about it too much. But to keep it in perspective, because, you know, we hear about these teachings and we can get so kind of compulsive about it, get so caught up with it, you know, trying to get these. I mean, I remember in a meditation center in Sri Lanka, you know, when I read about the Eightfold Path. We weren't supposed to read, actually, but I had a little book there anyway. Just a little one. One of these kind of miniature books I got in India, you know. And then I was looking at it, you know, on the Eightfold Path. I came across the Eightfold Path, and then it was, oh yes, right. And then I got really kind of a bit obsessive about it, you know. Oh, right speech. Oh, I've got to be really careful with my speech. And the right action. Oh, don't hit that mosquito. And then right livelihood. What? Wasn't doing anything anyway. But I had the kind of, I was just like, I had this image of me juggling these eightfold things, eight factors, you know, juggling them, trying to keep them all in the air at the same time. And, oh, my head. Gave me a headache. And I'm just trying to figure out these eight factors, you know, and of course it was, you know, right, you know, the right practice, but at the same time it just filled my head up with more concepts and ideas. And then just to be able to put them aside and actually do the practice. And the idea is, I mean, once we've learned, I don't think we have to learn to be, you know, kind of experts in the Eightfold Path. That's why I think even people have heard them before. But you go over them again and you review them, you see them in a new way, you understand them at a deeper level. Wisdom or understanding is deepening. Not just getting more information, but it needs to be deepened too. I was just on my retreat because I had given, I think, three talks, you know, about suffering and the cause of suffering, and the cessation of suffering. That was a good three talks to start off with, anyway. But it kept returning in my retreat, did it? Kept coming back in the back. Of course, I can't say I got to the cessation of suffering, but it was more like working on the first one. Deeper and deeper in the first one. But it kind of seeds our reflections, our contemplations. And ideally it needs to go into a deeper level where it becomes part of our being then. And you know, when we are the eight-factored path, as it were. We don't need to think about it outside. It's not something out there that the Buddha gave us out there. It's something which is coming from within us. That we are inclining towards, you know, right understanding and right aspiration, and these things, they are part of our way of relating to reality, the world. And they become part of our own experience, direct experience then. And then as we, you know, as a kind of a finale to Venerable Sariputta, we can say that we know that. We have confirmed it. This eight-factored path does work. And one of the scriptures, the Buddha, well, I think quite a few times, and I think it was the scripture about his final passing. And many times he kept saying, you know, when there is these eight factors, when there is, people have the morality, the meditation, and the wisdom part, then the world will not be bereft of enlightened beings. You know, only by the continual practice of these eight factors will, is it possible to have awakened beings in the world. And you keep emphasizing this again and again and again. That only when you have these eight factors coming together is the possibility to realize the path, to realize the realization of awakening. Not just one of them or a few of them, but all these factors. And the more that we can keep them going and practice them, to know about them is one thing, but to practice them and put them into our life, and they become a living example. And not something we just pick up in an old book someday and dust it off, and, oh yes, the Eightfold Path. But it's a living example of, you know, people can realize it and practice it and live it. Live this teaching. So that's why, you know, the study, the practice, and the realization. The realization is all yours.